This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark. We use analogies every day, and yet we rarely even think about them, right? That they're just sort of part of our vocabulary, our speech, our lexicon. But for John Pollock, analogies are not something to be ignored. Pollock is the author of the new book, Shortcut: How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas. Hi, John.
Hi.
So I have to say, when reading this book, one sort of has this huge aha moment where, you know, we all use analogies, but I don't think many of us realize how influential they are in everyday life.
Well, you're right. And that's because they're so central to our thinking that we don't even recognize that they're there, but they often have big consequences on how we view the world. As I say, there are a lot of analogies that ring true that actually turn out not to be true. For example, the domino theory. A reporter in 1954 asked President Eisenhower, "What's the strategic significance of French Indochina?" And he said, "Well, set up a row of dominoes and tip the first one over, and the next one goes, and the next one goes, and sure enough, the last one will tip over. If we don't stop the communists in Vietnam, there goes Cambodia, Laos, Malaysia, Thailand, and pretty soon they're knocking at our door." And that analogy translated something that was complex and far away into everyday language that ordinary Americans could understand. And while it wasn't solely responsible for the escalation, it certainly framed America's thinking about Vietnam and sold the country on the dangers. And we lost thousands and thousands and thousands of soldiers. There were many more Vietnamese killed. It cost billions of dollars. And we lost. And then, of course, the analogy proved to be completely false because the neighboring countries didn't topple like dominoes. And the reason is that countries have different cultures, politics, leaders, geography, and dominoes are little square tabletop blocks. That mistake was very costly.
John, one of the things that I found most fascinating was the idea of inventions. Everything from the printing press, the Wright brothers, Ford, and the moving assembly, you take us back to the fact that a lot of these things happen because of analogies.
You're absolutely right. Analogies, while they can be misleading sometimes, can also be extraordinarily revealing in new and powerful ways. And we see that through the history of invention. Let's take a recent example, a relatively recent example, and that is when Steve Jobs and Apple introduced the Mac in 1984. Until that time, computers had been very difficult and unfriendly. And as a consequence, you had to be a techie to use them. And when he took the desktop analogy, he translated not just through technology, but in terms of explaining the new technology, how everyday people could use a computer by taking something that was horizontal, a physical desktop, and making it vertical and digital with an icon for a file folder, with an icon for a trash can. People suddenly said, well, I can use a desktop, so I can use a Mac. And then, of course, that was copied by other manufacturers and software makers. And now billions of people can use a computer. And it was that desktop analogy that really made it possible and persuaded people that they could exploit the power of a computer.
In the book, Shortcut, you kind of give us five ways or five different things that make a good analogy. Help us understand what makes for a good analogy.
Well, there are three that are most important that I think that people can apply to their thinking that will help them the most. One is all analogies highlight some things and hide other things. And so we need to question the analogies that we hear. When someone makes an analogy, they're making an argument. They're asserting certain things, making the case for similarities. We need to ask, well, what about this analogy doesn't work? Now, it might be that on careful examination, the analogy is just fine and it works and there are no downsides. But it might be that your comparison reveals flaws and disqualifying flaws. So that's one, question the analogies you hear. Second, effective analogies play on our emotions. For example, in the Iowa Senate race that's going on right now, the Republican candidate ran an ad that said, "I grew up on a hog farm castrating pigs. Send me to Washington, I'll cut pork." And it's a tremendously appealing, funny ad that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you like her or you don't like her, it's a great and appealing analogy. It happens to be wrong because the skill set of hog castration are completely different than the skill set of negotiating and finding compromise in the Senate.
One would assume.
Let's hope so. There's mud flying in both. So, but this illustrates how appealing that analogy is because it plays on our emotions, our frustration with Washington, our low opinion of many elected officials, not all of them, because there are great elected officials trying to do good work, but the general reputation of Washington is somewhat well-earned these days. So the third thing is that people should explore multiple analogies because there's always more than one that will fit any given situation. And analogies are models. And before you marry one model, you should date some others.
Some of the biggest speeches and political parts of history, you bring up analogies in them. FDR and his fireside chats, full of analogies. MLK's I Have a Dream speech, full of analogies. Reagan, Morning in America. Why are analogies so present in politics?
Well, politics presents an interesting challenge because running a country or solving some of the toughest issues that we confront as a country, it's a challenge, and there are no easy solutions. Or if there were easy solutions, we'd have solved all these problems by now. But people's attention spans are short. People don't have time to go into these issues in depth. And so leaders and candidates often use analogies to distill something complicated into something simpler to understand. Just like the Senate candidate in Iowa, again, talks about hog castration and cutting pork. Pork is an analogy. Throughout history, we see some great examples. You mentioned FDR and the fireside chats. Well, before the United States entered World War II, Great Britain was under attack from the Nazis, and there was a lot of debate in the United States, should we help them by providing war material? And, of course, President Roosevelt was very strongly in favor of supporting them. And there were isolationists in Congress that said, we have no interest in this war. We want no part of it. Mm-hmm. Let's stay out. And at a press conference, Roosevelt grew frustrated and he said, look, if your neighbor's house is on fire and you have a garden hose, you're not going to say, hey, pay me $15 for my garden hose. You're going to lend the hose, hook it up to the hydrant, put out the fire, and if the hose gets damaged, then you'll talk about it later and be compensated later. And that garden hose analogy, as it came to be known, really swayed public opinion. And the United States was able to implement and pass through Congress the Lend-Lease program that provided a lot of crucial support to Great Britain at a critical time until the United States, of course, entered the war after Pearl Harbor.
John, as you write in the book, analogies are not always perfect, and you write about the danger that they can pose. You know, making certain political statements too easy to understand, for example. You write about the three strikes law in California or balancing the federal budget like a household budget.
Right. Let's talk about the federal budget and the household budget analogy because it's a completely false analogy. Now, one can see the appeal of the analogy because we all live in households and we can't spend more than we take in for very long or we get into big trouble. And you hear leaders on the right saying, you know, this is like a household budget. We need to cut government. Well, there's some big differences between a household budget and a government budget. First of all, the needs of the United States of America are perpetual. That is, they go on in perpetuity, year after year, decade after decade, century after century, and they require big investments. If we had never made the Louisiana Purchase, which was a huge amount of debt, if we had never invested in the interstate highway system, for example, we wouldn't be the nation we are today. And so the debt of the United States of America has been in debt since its founding for every year but one during the Jackson administration. And that debt has, generally speaking, served the United States well because it's allowed us to finance great leaps forward. The second thing is that as a household, you can either cut your expenses or work more hours and try and bring in more money. But the United States of America has, you know, big tools that it can use. We can influence the inflation rate and bring down the cost of money for our debt. We can print more money. We can issue debt. And so that analogy breaks down very quickly, both in terms of the goals of the country, the needs of the country, and the means at its disposal. But again, the analogy is appealing, and that's why it's important for people to think critically about these analogies and not bite a hook and suddenly find yourself dangling on a line.
The other example that you give is the three strikes law in California, which I think sounds very reasonable to some folks. Three strikes, that's what you get in baseball.
Right, and the three strikes ballot initiative, which sent third-time offenders to prison for 25 years to life, came out of a genuine revulsion against repeat criminals in the 1990s and a desire to get tough on crime and a completely legitimate need of society. And that law was from California, became a model for three strikes laws in about half the states. The problem with three strikes laws is that the third offense in many cases turned out to be someone stealing a slice of pizza or breaking into a car to take change from a cup holder. And that, of course, fills up prisons with nonviolent offenders that cost $50,000 apiece every year. And so our annual prison tab is something in the neighborhood of $75 billion. And we've got over 2 million prisoners. And so three strikes laws are very costly, and you need to ask, well, why are we modeling our penal policy on baseball? What do the two have in common? Again, here's where the emotions come into play. We think of baseball as being fair. It has rules. They're very clear rules. And when an umpire makes a decision, that decision is final. The other thing about baseball is that it's very statistically driven. There are stats for everything in baseball, and there's a great sense of personal accountability to the game. And so when you frame the challenge of prison and sentencing policy in terms of baseball, that emotion transfers over, and it becomes a very persuasive selling tool, and the analogy leads us astray.
Right. You know, writers Keith Holyoke and Paul Thagard, who write analogies should enhance thinking, not substitute for it.
That's exactly right. And so we need to be critical thinkers about the analogies that we encounter.
Talking about the three strikes law in California and then election 2014 heating up, and it feels like we hear a lot about battling and campaigns. Why is it that in present day, sports and war analogies seem to be used the most?
Well, we've got a lot of sports and we've got a lot of war, so there's a lot of material to work with. Second is, we use certain analogies to import emotion from one situation to another. And in the case of sports, we're trying to up the ante by making war analogies. In a war, you might be trying to calm people down yet motivate them as they go into battle. And so you frame things in terms of sports and teamwork and victory. And so there are close relationships between the two, but of course they're very different because in sports you've got very specific rules and a growing consciousness of violence and the costs of violence and the limits on violence. And in war, it seems increasingly anything goes. And they're very different, but there's a lot of, as you noted, crossover between the language. You know, it's interesting. If you look at football today, and you go to games, there's been an increase in the militarization of football. Mm. You have more flyovers, you have more flags. There is a deep association between war and football. Even the language of football, you know, the linemen are in the trenches. You have the blitz. You're throwing the bomb. It becomes a self-reinforcing cycle of language that the nuclear codes that are manacled to a military aide of the president that's colloquially known as the football. And I think that in a sense, these become cliches that people rely on. We hear so many sports cliches in business. Well, don't drop the ball. Keep your eye on the ball. And while sometimes these analogies can be useful, cliches are desiccated analogies, and they lose their effectiveness over time as people forget the original meaning. And the most effective leaders are those who can come up with fresh analogies.
And when it comes to war and campaigns, it seems like particularly right now you can't read a newspaper, you can't turn on the TV without hearing about election 2014 and candidates and the war of words or duking it out or battling campaigns.
Yeah, or even campaigns themselves. There were military campaigns before there were political campaigns because the wars predate democracy.
Finally, John, I just have to ask, do you have a favorite analogy?
Well, I like the analogy that is perfect in its own moment, that brings clarity to a situation. I think that the best analogies are often ephemeral, but serve their purpose, and then we move on. So I'd hate to show favoritism to any particular analogy.
Fair enough. John Pollack, former White House speechwriter and author of the new book Shortcut, How Analogies Reveal Connections, Spark Innovation, and Sell Our Greatest Ideas. John, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on, Zoe.